Session number 28934, Len Trevelyan, part 6.
Len, you've telling us that you've just landed at Gibraltar, quite against the rules, and what happened to you after that?
Well, obviously because of the unceremonious landing there, my name of myself and my crew were passed to the officer in command, and he came down to see me. Well, at least someone from his office came down to see me, and who should it be but Philip Kirby Green, who had left in London quite a few months before, when we were dodging the bombs in Wandsworth and Putney, and here he was in charge of the border control. He was officer in charge of the border control between Spain and the ROC, and a member of the security service. And he was delighted to see me, of course, and he entertained me royally, and I had meals in his mess. I can't remember what my crew did. They obviously were taken somewhere to have meals and hospitality. And I know Philip said to me, he said, if you can stay here another day, he said, I'll take you across to Tangier and we can have a real good time over there. But anyway, I had to get across with my reinforced aircraft to Bleeder as quickly as I could. And so the next day, having replenished, I think must have taken all the petrol on their station, we flew across to Bleeder. And
Len, before you carry on, you were an officer, and your crew were sergeants.
Sergeants, yes.
What was the sort of the difference between the way that you lived?
Well, in fact, there was very little socialising between the two. They lived in a sergeant's mess, and I lived in an officer's mess. So right the way through, whether it was in operations, there was the sergeant's mess and operations. We didn't really get together, except that we were, you know, the most of the time it was debriefing when we landed after a trip or an operation, and we sat together around the table and told the debriefing officer what had happened. But then we both made our own ways, and of course we weren't unfriendly with each other, but there was no real, there was no means of getting together very much. As officers, you stuck together with your few friends, although I found that throughout my service it never paid to get very close to anyone as a friend, and you didn't make any silly promises to anyone about keeping up friendship, because you knew it would never last, and many's the time in Italy, when we're living under four of us at a time in a 6 foot tent, that night after night there would be a different member coming into you. You'd lose one of your members, you know, you would lose one of your colleagues, and very callously you'd say, well, are his gloves better than mine? How do his boots fit you? We'd make sure that his personal documents were given to the CO, ready to send to the family. But you couldn't lose a great deal of sleep over the loss of a colleague. You were just treated as one of the hazards of life there. You know, we became very callous as far as life was concerned, and therefore we didn't make very close friends. You know, you didn't become real buddies or real mates with any particular person. It was a sad state of affairs, but that's how it was. So, anyway, after we left at Gib, and I don't even remember to this day asking my crew how they got on or how they fared. We just met at the aircraft the next day and then flew across to Bleeder, and I presume Len Rivett knew that, had a map reading or a reference, and he directed us over there on the, which wasn't a long flight, and I'm sure he must, well, there must have been more into that, but I can't remember these days how we got from one place to another. Anyway, we did land at Bleeder, and there were other aircraft that had landed over the last 24 hours from Great Britain, these new Blenheims, and the commanding officer of the squadron was, we were checking into him and telling what aircraft we'd bought. And when I handed my aircraft in, the commanding officer was Wing Commander Thompson. He said, "Look," he said, we badly need these new aircraft, but we also badly need crew. He said, "Would you consider staying on here?" So I said, "Well, I think we'd like it very much, but I must ask my crew." So I went and saw Freddie and Len and said, "CO would like us to stay on the squadron. Now that we're over here," they said, "Oh, yes, please, we'd love to do it." So I went and told him, "Yes, I'll stay with you." And I said, "What squadron is it?" He said, "It's 13 Squadron. I thought, well, destiny has sent me here. I really am happy with this decision, and so it proved to be. I had a wonderful survival time. Although everyone else was dropping off the side, I survived until I finished my tour on that squadron. 52 operational trips. Mostly, there weren't anything dramatic or daring about them, monotonous. It was mostly during that period flying for hours on end round convoys passing through the Mediterranean, protecting them from submarines and attacks from any other aircraft that may have come along. Not that we were much of a defence against them, but nevertheless, we were used in that capacity to fly around them and protect them. This was in the build-up to the Sicilian landings, you know, the supplies were going through.
Then, what would have happened to you if you hadn't accepted the offer? Did you know what your future...
No. Right the way through my career, I've done, you know, I have never influenced my postings or asked for a particular posting right from the very, very first time. And I often wonder, even if at the... stage when I came back from the States as a new pilot, whether if they'd have put me on fighter planes, what my career would have been. I probably wouldn't have been here now if I'd have had gone straight into the Battle of Britain, as it were. So, you know, I've thought fate has dealt me some very nice cards over the years to have got through the way I did. And even in the latter stages, which I'll tell you about, in Italy, I survived, whereas most others didn't, you know, and it was not due to any terrific flying on my part, it was due to good fortune. Anyway, that took us across to Bleda and joining 13 Squadron. And one little incident that before I got into ops, we were allowed to go down to the shore at Maison Blanche, I think it was. One of the trucks took the crews waiting for operations down to the shore to have a swim. And I went down with this truck, my shorts and a towel around my shoulders, down to the beach to swim. Quite a few miles from Bleda down to the beach, but nevertheless, we got down there. And I went in swimming, but in walking out to swim, I put my foot on a spiny, what are they called, the little spiny sea growths, black...
Sea urchin?
Sea urchin, that's the word. I trod on a sea urchin and the whole of the spines came off in the ball of my foot. It was black with spines and I just couldn't put my foot to the ground. They helped me back into the truck. And I went back to the station and went into sick quarters, still in a wet bathing costume. And the nurse, one of the nurses there, I forget what group it was, Queen Anne's Nursing Service, I lay on my tummy while she pulled the tweezers out, pulled all the spines out with the tweezers. And my foot was absolutely raw after that. And I had to spend a couple of days on the sick bay before I could get flying again. So I didn't go swimming again, not until I got to the canal zone where the water was a bit, you know, sandy beaches and so on. but I can remember that. I understand when we were talking to the maintenance crew that we handed the aircraft over when we arrived at Bleda, that they immediately started to strip off all the stuff, the armour plating protection around the crews and the cannon underneath, cannon suspended under the body. And they, in fact, they stripped it back as everything off that they could, so that it had longer endurance and greater speed. Because it, I know that flying it out there, it was just like a wallowing whale through the air. You know, you couldn't take your hands off and leave it to fly straight and level. Anyway, all the excitement of joining the squadron was rather disappointing when we found that we were going to have to spend time on the ground, but. I did make the best of it. I went up to the Atlas Mountains. I went up to an old French ski resort at Medea, up in the, and saw, there was no snow there, of course, at that time, but I saw the ski lifts and the ski runs, and that was very interesting. And you could look over the other side onto the Sahara Desert. So it was more or less an eye-opener to see what the Atlas Mountains were like. Another occasion that we went swimming. You know, I've mentioned how I got the sea urchin in my foot, but we did go down and have at least sunbathing and had a little bit of relaxation and went around the town of Bleda. But the whole of my experience on 13 Squadron as it developed, and I realise now, it was to protect the convoys, and we didn't know where they would be. And so in order to place ourselves in a suitable situation to be ready to escort a convoy, we had to go on detachments. And that is why I remember that we went to so many little aerodromes between Algiers and Cape Bon, which was, of course, the nearest point to go across to Sicily. We spent a detachment, four or five of us would go across with a minimum ground crew and spend a few days when a particular convoy was coming along. Or apparently they had information that when submarines were in a certain area, because it was, they obviously didn't have submarines patrolling the Med the whole of the time, they went there when they thought there was going to be a convoy coming through. And so we tried to coordinate our flying depending upon A, whether there was a convoy coming through, or B, whether there was submarines expected. And it was very tedious, tiring type of flying. When you were looking for submarines, it meant flying quite low, skimming eyes tied to the sea surface to see if there's the least little sight of a periscope coming up, and you got a lot of false alarms. One of the crew, Freddy or Rivet, would say, "Is that something over there?" And you'd go across and go down, and you'd find it was a seabird or something like that, and all waves breaking in a peculiar position, and your eyes went goggly when you were watching the sea for so long, because it's almost mesmeratic to look at the waves of the sea continuously, the breaking of the waves, particularly if there's a little bit of wind, and taking the top off each roller and making it into a whatever it is they call it, the little spray of white. So we were glad to get to the end of that type of operation, and I think it carried on almost to the end of the year, because Even when we'd taken Sicily, when that was, I forget the date that Sicily was taken, but even after the fall of Sicily, there were all the supplies coming. The convoys were coming along the Med to supply Sicily, and they were as vital to get there as before they landed.
And just to take you back a bit, what was you going to do if you found a submarine?
Well, we were carrying depth charges, and we would we had all the practice of depth charging and so on. we used to have these exercises on little islands off the coast. They'd find little isolated islands or little places off the coast that we could use as a bombing range or a practice range. And whenever there were no convoys expected, we used to do some bombing practice or firing practice, because we had a turret with 2.5s in, and I had 4.5s in the no, that was in the Baltimore. I had 2.5s in the Blenheim turret, I think, and we used to have to practice those, because we stood very little chance if a chance of survival if a enemy aircraft found us, but we nevertheless had a try at them. But
what would the tactics have been to attack a submarine? Would you have gone high?
Oh, well, you dashed. No, you had to be high enough to, I think it was 500 feet was ideal to drop your depth charges, but there were no lay-down tactics. You worked out which way it was going, if you could get a direction by the sight of the periscope, you'd go ahead of it and just hope that it continued on its route, or its track, as we call it, and just drop a couple. But I never had to drop. I didn't see a submarine, so I didn't have to drop any. So I don't know what it would have been like in reality to have dropped some. I think there were only two submarines sighted during the whole of the squadron's period in North Africa on this convoy patrol. So we were all looking forward to getting across to Sicily and subsequently Italy, or wherever the war was going to after that. And towards the end of the year, rumours were brought to us by other aircraft that there were no more Blenheims left, that no more Blenheims being produced at Filton. So as we ran out of aircraft, so that we would converted onto a new type. And this materialised towards the end of the year. I was on a detachment, I think it was at Bone, I can't remember exactly where, somewhere near Bizerta, and the rest of the squadron were taken up to the canal zone near Suez to convert onto another type of aircraft. We thought it was going to be a Ventura, which had much greater range for long patrols. But then there were rumours that the tactics of the war are going to change, and that because they thought it would be easier to go in the underbelly of Germany, they might go up through the Balkans. And so there were all sorts of rumours as to what was happening to us. And as I say, I was on detachment, still on the submarine patrol, and the rest of the squadron went up and converted onto Venturas. But immediately the plan was changed, and they had to convert onto Baltimores.
Were you sorry to see the Blenheim go?
Or we were, because it was a slow. I mean, it did its job. It did its job of patrolling the convoys and the submarines searches. But the war in the desert had finished by then, and we were looking for the next phase. You know, there was virtually a standstill in progress in Europe, and. And then, after we had taken Sicily, of course, we started to creep up Italy. And this is when the Baltimores were given to us. We went up Italy, and that's when the just towards the end of my career, when a flying career, when Monte Cassino came into the picture, and that was the last stalemate. As far as the movement was concerned, until we broke that, no movement could be made advancing up Italy. But there was a lot transpired, I realised, between that and where I've reached in my story about the convoys. I remember when I got back to the squadron from detachment, there was one Ventura left, and this had to be taken back along the North African coast to what was the name of the place? Just back of Oran, the station at the back of Oran. And so Rivett and I decided to take this on our own. We didn't need Freddie, it was just a handover. And I got Rivett to make a flight plan, but we were going to, as it was meant, right coast, going along the coast, we were going to coast crawl right the way from right up to Oran. But as we took off, there was a rainstorm built up, and it turned into a thunderstorm when we took off, and we were in 10 tenths cloud, reading in, entirely flying on instruments. And we thought, well, I wonder how long this is going to be. And Rivett tried to get some readings through the clouds, but there were no breaks, and so we had to stick on instruments. I'd never flown the aircraft before, just sat into it for the first time on that trip, and there was automatic pilot on it, but I hadn't a clue. I'd never been shown how to use the automatic pilot. I switched it in as I thought, but the movement, the controls are so violent, whether it was natural in a storm, but the movement was so violent, I thought we're going to wreck the ailerons and rudder if it's as violent as this. So I switched back from the automatic pilot and flew by hand on. When we'd almost we were in despair, and we thought, well, we're never going to see where we are. We can't see any sighting of land or sea or mountains or anything. And we realized that on our port side, we had the Atlas Mountains, just inland off the shore. To the starboard side, we had the sea. And yet we didn't know whether we were over one or the other. And we were we debated whether we should, when we got to the ETA, our estimated time of landing, we should just point the aircraft out to sea and jump and hope that we'd land on land and not on the water or up in the mountains. Because the alternative, we didn't know how high the Atlas Mountains were, and we would have been flying at a steady 3,000 or 4,000 feet, I suppose. And but just at that moment, we saw a little gap in the cloud, and I just turned the, although it was a big aircraft, I turned it over on its nose, and we went through this gap. And when we got through the gap, we saw green, and we realized that we were over land, and you know, it was fate, but there we were, right over the aerodrome that we were meant to land at. When I could see that it was the aerodrome that we were aiming for, I realized that the reason this rainstorm had flooded the aerodrome and the runway was underwater except for a short distance at the end. So I landed on the part of the runway that was still above water, and came to a halt with the wheels underwater, and someone in the flying control sent a lorry out to us, and we were able to get from the aircraft into the lorry, and we went back to the mess, and we were very grateful that we hadn't had to jump or crash. And I remember in that mess I met one of my old colleagues who'd Tim Reynolds, who'd been on the squadron, or on an adjacent squadron, another squadron that I knew him. He'd been a policeman in London, Tim Reynolds, and his father owned the Three Doves pub on the river at Ham. Anyway, that's getting off the point. we had to get joined. I think I got an American Dakota to get us back to to the squadron, and there the squadron were converting on to Baltimore's, I had my first flight into Baltimore, and found it a wonderful aircraft to fly.
How did it compare with the Blenheim?
It was a similar formation and size of a midwing,
midwing
monoplane with two engines, and it was we needed an extra air crew. We had a four-place crew instead of a three, because there was a belly gun, which was for firing downwards and backwards, and I was given or allocated a gunner who turned out to be Don Bebbington, the Canadian, and he and the Freddie and I had this familiarization in the Baltimore, one trip familiarization, and then we took it up on our own, and we had local flyings and landings, and it was a very tricky aircraft to land because it was so powerful and so light in ratio to its power that the torque of the engines, they wanted, you know, you would have very difficult to make a straight landing, and the reputation was that most people had had two or three prangs before they could fly it. But the whole of our squadron converted onto Baltimore's without a single casualty. So that shows the experience that we'd gained in that year flying Blenheims, similar size, but under trying conditions on sand and so on makeshift aerodromes. We were able to transfer onto Baltimore's without any mishaps. And right through January 1944, I think in January it must have been one, two, three, four. There were about 20, we had about 20 trips during January with either formation flying, Vicks of three, boxes of six, so on. The principle was that with the Baltimore, we were going to do close support bombing of targets like marshalling yards, ports, supply convoys in ports, any ammunition dumps and things like that were being met in the, now that the war was up in the front, the activity was up in Italy. We hadn't moved very far up Italy, and didn't get ahead of targets much more than Salerno at the outset. But in order to get the principle of close support bombing was that you had a box of six aircraft, and you would tighten up very close for the last minute or so of the run up to a target, so that you were almost wingtip to wingtip as you went in towards the target, and you could fly straight and level for about the last 20 or 30 seconds, because after that the gunners could locate you, because you'd been weaving and you didn't go fly straight to the target. You used to weave and appear to take one target and then come in towards the other target, so that gunners on the ground couldn't locate you. And the navigator in the leading aircraft, whoever he was, the commanding officer or the wing commander, would open the bomb doors, and the five of you would also open your bomb doors when you saw the leading aircraft bomb doors open, and you would be ready to drop your bombs as the CO or the leading aircraft dropped his bombs. You would press and drop yours, and with any luck you would have a pattern bombing say the size of a football pitch. But of course the CO or the leading aircraft had to drop his bomb short of the target, so that the rest in that slight delay gave the pattern covering about the size of a football pitch. And